open up your heart to the ceiling. Time will take you back to believing. That's Carly Rae Jepsen. I'm Blake Murphy. She's Julia Kreutz. This is Jay's Talk Plus. And I had to throw it back a little, awesome. Julia. And I know it's selfish of me to go back to the gimmick I opened shows with when I was doing solo shows. However, over the course of, this is year four doing this show, and I think I did that I open with a lyric that tries to fit the mood of the team for two of those years. And I didn't plan them out too far in advance. Usually I thought of them the morning of, based on how I was feeling about the team. But there were precious few positive ones.
Yeah.
So I felt like I needed to get one in here because there were no nice ones the last 2 years. And right now, things feeling pretty good. Things feeling pretty Carly Rae Jepsen, pretty open up your hearts.
You know what? Yes, things are feeling pretty Carly Rae Jepsen. You are absolutely right about that. And you should every once in a while or every day, whatever you want to do. You still do this show solo most of it anyway.
That's not true. That's not true. Okay, before we get into game stuff, you mentioned Show Ali yesterday. Right. You did the, well, my other co-host, because the Blue Jays had an afternoon game yesterday, I got to watch game three of the NBA Finals. By the way, in a Pascal Siakam hoodie today. Shout out to the Pacers.
That.
Yes, sirs. Anyway, I watched the game with Amit, our producer, and Matt Bonner, my other co-host. I'll just say this. For no reason whatsoever, Matt brought me a gift.
What?
So it was for anyone who, and I'm sorry for anyone who doesn't listen to the Raptors show as well. It was an Orlando Robinson basketball card. So this is the equivalent of you finding, like, after yesterday's show, finding like the most rare and exclusive Will Robertson Buffalo Bisons card for me. That's the equivalent there. Anyway, I just want to let you know that we can both do the, well, my other co-host.
Wow. Listen.
Mom lets me do it.
First of all, I'm really happy for you. I'm really happy for you. He sounds like a great guy.
He's the best. Yeah.
Maybe he is watching this show.
He's definitely not.
And he's seeing me giving you coffee once a week or whatever, which I prepare with all my love.
Yeah.
So
here's a question, not to derail this even further, how do you, so you have a couple times brought me coffee, a couple times brought Amit coffee.
Yeah.
How do you decide if it's a Blake, an Amit, or a nobody coffee day?
So the first time I told Amit I was going to bring him coffee was actually the day you weren't here. And I was like, well, Amit is really, really, you know, earning his paycheck today, so I might as well bring him some coffee. But he had already gotten coffee, so I said, okay, never mind then. I'm not going to. And so I told him ahead of time this week, the night before, I said, hey, I'm bringing you coffee tomorrow. Like, don't go anywhere. Don't buy coffee. I got you. And then I'm in the car driving with two coffee cups, which is a challenge to carry into the building, by the way, because I'm a very clumsy person.
Okay.
And he texted me. I was already in the car. Oh, I totally forgot that you were going to bring me coffee. And I went in and got coffee anyway. Said, well, buddy, so in that case, you are drinking two cups of coffee this morning.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, look, when you've brought it in for me, that's my second cup on those days. So I'm,
nice.
No arguments here. That was very nice of you for Amit. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, we all need a little bit of a pick-me-up, especially when the games start later than 7 p.m.
Yes. In the spirit of spreading the touches around co-host-wise and things like that, we're going to let you guys control at least one segment today. We're going to do a bunch of text line mailbag stuff later in the show. We have Derek Van Riper of The Athletic and Rates and Barrels coming on. We got John Morosi coming on. But later in the show, we'll do some text line stuff. So you can send us your text to 590-590. Standard message and data rates may apply. We'll get to those a little later in the show. For now, though, we got to break down yet another Blue Jays win. They sweep the St. Louis Cardinals. Jamie Campbell throws a broom at the camera. That was one of the best. Someone sent me a screenshot, and it's like, it's Jamie and Arden in the background, and the broom is like about to hit the camera lens. Great throw, Jamie. Jays win this one 5-2, and we checked a bunch of boxes. 21st comeback victory of the season. They didn't do that until late August last year. 12-2 stretch for the first time since the September 2021 playoff push, and another win on a bullpen day. They just keep doing it. 5 straight series win, 22-10 over the last 32. They're like, we are quickly turning the page from they have made up the ground in the wild card to, 4 games isn't that much. What if the Yankees drop a couple? The Yankees look really good, but what if they drop a couple?
What if? And we'll talk to John Morosi about these Yankees in a little bit as well. But it's not out of the realm of possibility, which, you know, you look back at, I don't know, 6 weeks ago. It's funny that we never got a first place show, yeah. even though they were in first place for a little bit. And then when we started is where things started to go awry for the Jays. And now we can start dreaming about a first place show again. Obviously, this is going to be a tight division race, and the Yankees are still the favorites in my mind, barring something crazy happening there. But yeah, why not dream? It seems like it's for real. Again, you hear the quotes post game. They believe it as well, and they believe in it in a way that they didn't last season. That much is very clear, even in the way that players and the manager are talking right now. And why wouldn't you? Because they are doing it in so many different ways. The bullpen day is one aspect of it, and you kind of just, you know, it's next man up. But then on the offensive side, there's power, but there's also the small ball that we saw yesterday, a ton of strategy behind the way that the Blue Jays played yesterday offensively. Two sack flies.
Two sacrifice bunts.
Two sack bunts. Sure, Ernie Clement chipped in with a home run just so we don't, you know, forget that that's also a possibility. Yeah. But there was a little bit of everything.
Vlad stole a base, which is like, you know, he's an opportunistic base stealer, not a you're doing this all the time because it's small ball. But even something like that, and they tried another one. I thought Ernie Clement got a good enough jump on his. Ernie Clement just like really, he went through and he's like, what is every box I can tick off to make this game about me? And he had a single, he had a double, he had a home run, he hit into a double play, he got caught stealing, he was wearing pants that were too large because something happened with his and he had to wear someone else's pants, and he got pulled from the game injured on top of everything else. Really just did everything you can possibly do in a game other than maybe pitch.
That right there is a complete performance. And anything other than that or below that is not a complete performance. They were about in Francis' pants. I think they broke it down a little bit in the broadcast.
I couldn't remember whose pants it was.
Yeah.
And
can you believe it?
Thankfully, it seems like Ernie Clement avoided real injury. Yeah. So for anyone who missed it in the eighth inning, he dove to his left, he was playing third base. He kind of tried to dive into the hole toward shortstop. And on the like lateral movement, he seemed to tweak his left knee. He landed pretty hard as well, but he got up and he was kind of favoring it. They came out. I had one person suggest to me in the DMs, and this was actually really clever. Brandon Little was in the middle of a 31-pitch inning that he was laboring. And so someone messaged me and was like, is he faking that to like get Brandon Little an extra breather? But then Ernie had to come out of the game. They said after the game it was just a precaution because there's an off day today. They joked. They made the hockey joke that it's a lower body injury. They won't get more specific. But yeah, if this had been worse, he wore the like LOL, he's so wacky, he wore someone else's pants. If he had like tripped on Bound Francis' pants and injured his knee,
that would have been bad. But, you know, I think they're smart enough not to let something like that happen and to test it out sort of beforehand and see if, you know, your motion is affected or, but it looked weird.
Also, like there are a bunch of guys on that team who are much closer to Ernie Clement in pant size than Bowden Francis.
They were going for the shock value.
I guess.
Obviously.
This is Ernie Clement is also now weeks of hitting with Miles Straw's torpedo bat. Yep. Now wearing Bowden Francis's pants. He's tried to do the Davis Schneider mustache for the Jays social media stuff. Ernie Clement is going to be like a ship of Theseus by the end, where he's just like part of every Blue Jay, but is it still Ernie Clement? He's going to have Bo Bichette's glove and Andrés Giménez's cleats, and we'll see. It'll just be a whole different Ernie. But what a game for Ernie Clement. The single, the double, the home run, obviously the good defense. And one part of this is something we know about Ernie Clement. It didn't really come out statistically last year, but we think of him as a guy who mashes lefties. He's a guy who's going to take advantage of the platoon advantage. So far this season against lefties, and it's only 68 plate appearances because the Blue Jays had that long run of weeks without facing a lefty. He is hitting .400 with a .234 weighted runs created plus. So more than double, like that's an Aaron Judge weighted runs created plus when Ernie Clement is playing against lefties. Again, 68 plate appearances, but really nice to see. The other aspect of this was every time the Blue Jays face a good, smart opponent, Ernie Clement sees tons of off-speed and breaking stuff early in the count. And he might get a fastball later on, but the Tampa Bay Rays aren't throwing Ernie Clement an early count fastball. Matthew Liberatore yesterday in all three, I believe all three of Ernie Clement's hits came on early count fastballs. So I dug in this morning, and if he gets a fastball or sinker on the first three pitches of a plate appearance, he's hitting 352 and slugging 520 off of them. How are teams still giving him 0-1 and 1-0 fastballs in the zone?
That was, I think, the most shocking part of, you know, what Clement did, because you watch him do it and you're like, yep, that is Ernie. He crushes lefties and he crushes fastballs. We all know that. But it was the fact that they kept coming back to it when they had been burned already. I don't know. I don't know if it's a reverse psychology thing, but that is where I think maybe game planning and strategy can get a bit too granular of like, well, he's not expecting an early count fastball because he hasn't seen
many. So you think it's a game theory thing of like, oh, so few teams have been giving him early count fastballs. Maybe I can trick him with one.
It would have to. What other explanation? Obviously, you know, I wasn't there, but that was the one that came to mind because it happened three times.
And it was interesting because Liberatore was fastball heavy the first time through the order. And then really leaned on, I think it was his curveball he was throwing a lot the second time through the order. But Ernie Clement still got, I think he got a first pitch curveball, but then a second pitch fastball.
Which landed nowhere
again.
Near the zone. Yeah. And, you know, sure, there's an element of confidence there of, I just missed with this pitch. I might as well just get back into the count and reset. But you can't do that against a guy like Ernie Clement. In that case, you probably should go back to the curveball. And if you miss again, that's okay. Then you reevaluate. But, you know, that is the magic of doubling up on pitches, especially off-speed pitches against guys like that. He was ready for it. I mean, and that's the thing, right? He has been locked in. He has been ready for it. And it's showing up and it's continuing to show up, which is important as well, because when he broke out a little bit earlier in the season, I was like, okay, this is nice. We'll see if it's a streak or if it can actually be sustained here as teams adjust, as he sees fewer fastballs. And so far, so good. I mean, it's still the Ernie Clement, and it's kind of closer to what we saw from him last season. And let's not forget the huge importance of having a guy who can play pretty much anywhere in the infield.
Well, what is it? He played four different positions the last four games.
He should be a front runner for the utility gold. Right?
Yeah, we'll see. Like, sometimes that one's going to come down to, like, did you get enough playing time?
Right.
And I think the way things look right now, Ernie Clement's going to get plenty of playing time in part because Jimenez was down. If Addison Barger cools off or something, it's not out of the realm of possibility that the Blue Jays would add a bat and that squeezes things later in the year. But we can deal with that when we get to it. For now, pretty good stuff from Ernie Clement on both sides of the ball. The other thing that I really like about Ernie Clement's approach through all of this is we know Ernie Clement as an aggressive swinger, right? Yeah. He is, among qualified hitters, I just looked it up, the fewest pitches per plate appearance of Jacob Wilson takes more pitches per plate appearance than Ernie Clement. Hebert Ruiz and Yainer Diaz, who are like the free swingers and the big chasers, take fewer pitches than Ernie Clement. He's last in the league. However, you saw in those plate appearances against Liberatore, because the contact profile is so high, it's not I have to swing at every single pitch. It's like he took an 0-0 curveball for a called strike in an earlier plate appearance, not the one where he homered in, but I think the one where he singled. He just took one. It was over the plate. It was like, it was actually pretty like hung.
Yep.
But he took it. It wasn't what he's looking for or whatever. I like it. Like, this is when we talk about sometimes with Bo Bichette that you can't always, you know, you can't, and Bo's done a much better job lately of not chasing and things like that. But you don't want him to get like too passive, because him being aggressive is part of what makes him so special and so difficult to pitch against. Ernie Clement has a lot of that too. And it's the aggression is the most aggressive in the league, but it's with a purpose. And it's, if you're going to throw me an 0-1 or a 1-0 fastball and it's anywhere near the zone, I'm going to jump all over it. Why, you know, even if it's a little below the zone, say, we know Ernie's got that play coverage. We've seen him hit the lowest home run, I think, any Blue Jay hit, and the highest home run since like Kevin Pillar or something like that last year. I'd have to double check the Chris Black stats on that one. But yeah, if you trust your contact profile and you don't mind getting the two strikes, if you swing and miss, that kind of stuff, it's good. It's cool to see Ernie Clement this locked in, because there were, he had a little bit of a lull there before the last little bit. And obviously the defense is going to keep him in the lineup fairly often. But nice to see the bat coming back around in a big way, especially against lefties.
Yeah, he doesn't have to produce three hits a game. He doesn't have to homer or even, honestly, hit for extra bases all that often. I think the defense and just the ability to put the ball in play should keep Ernie around, we'll see how things go when guys start getting healthy. I know it's not going to necessarily impact the infield, but it should impact Ernie's playing time, which is something that we keep talking about, and then someone else goes down.
Yeah.
You know?
The Dan Shulman favorite line is, these things have a way of working themselves out when you talk about it. Usually that's about bullpen spots or whatever. By the way, last 12 games for Ernie Clement, hitting .385 with almost a .700 slugging. So he has really come around after that kind of mid-May lull he had there. Speaking of the bullpen, you want to go to the bullpen?
Yeah, let's do it.
Two last notes, actually, before we go bullpen. John Schneider, I had meant to. I thought I had a nice little setup to get into Ernie Clement. Okay. John Schneider was like, it's a different guy every night. And it was. Like, we had yesterday's show was the Andrés Giménez show.
Yep.
A lot of the shows lately have been the Alejandro Kirk show, but the one before that was Alejandro Kirk. Saturday, where we don't do a show on Saturday or Sunday, but it's going to be the Bowden Francis show.
Yes.
I'm going to put, I have, the mustache is gone.
Are you putting that out into the universe?
I'm not saying like 7 innings.
Okay.
I think he goes 5 on Saturday, and that would be, I would feel good about that. And that's a Phillies lineup that he barely got out of the first against last time.
Right on.
I don't know. This is not an analytical thing. I have a feeling. Maybe it's the mustache being shaved that has me on it. The other thing I want to know, Ollie Marmol was very, very complimentary with the Blue Jays throughout the series. Said after the game, they beat us all 3 games. I don't feel like we gave a lot away. They took it to us.
I would agree with that, too. The Cardinals didn't play poorly. They didn't give anything away.
No. They came back a couple of times in those first 2 games.
They got off to a lead yesterday. Yeah. There was a lot there and that is a reason why yesterday I was a little reticent to call a sweep or something like that. Because, one, it was a bullpen day. We didn't know what we were going to get out of Spencer Turnbull. We didn't know how long he was going to go. And two, it has been a lot of small ball, especially with a guy like Liberatore on the mound. And I was wrong about that. I thought that maybe the Blue Jays would get themselves into trouble against a guy like that, who actually allows a ton of contact. But no, they kind of just adjusted and they continued to produce. So good to see. Honestly, refreshing that it was good news rather than bad news when I was expecting bad news. Kind of tells me that I should stay positive and optimistic during this stretch.
The important thing is to be correct, not necessarily. If you are negative and correct, that's better than being positive and incorrect.
Yeah.
Didn't work out, but I wouldn't change your entire outlook on life and baseball.
So you want me to stay negative?
I want you to stay true to what you're actually feeling and seeing when you're watching. And if that is negative, then it's negative. If it's positive, it's positive.
It did sort of allow me to reflect on, okay, why did I think that the Blue Jays would get into trouble here? And I think it's because I was thinking of the at-bats of early in the season rather than sort of adjusting my expectations to what the Blue Jays have been doing of late. That said, it's still good to see that they can thrive on the small ball. It's still good to see that they're not overly reliant on the home runs. And I don't think that this team can afford to be overly reliant on the home runs, but we had seen a lot of wins come like that, especially those comeback wins. Come sort of on the heels of homers and power and things of the sort. So,
and look, to be in your defense, if you were going to be worried about a game in this series, they eked one out Monday. They eked one out Tuesday. We didn't know, like, the closer wasn't going to be available. It was a bullpen day. It was a day game after a night game. It was the guy who's been, he hasn't pitched well 3 starts in a row now, but one of the Cardinals' most positive surprises of the season in Matthew Liberatore. It was a good game. And I guess this takes us to the bullpen, in which you think of a bullpen day as, like, if you can go 500 on bullpen days that you have to use, and you hope you don't have to use very many of them, you're thrilled, right? Of going 5. The Blue Jays are now 7-2 on their bullpen days. They're 2-1 in Eric Lauer's time leading the bullpen day, 1-1 with Jose Urena leading, 2-0 with Paxton Schultz leading, 1-0 with Braden Fisher leading, 1-0 with Yariel Rodriguez leading. Obviously, not all of those guys were effective, but 7-2 overall. I'm not counting the Easton Lucas and Max Scherzer ones, because even those were shorter starts. Right. Those guys were the starter. It wasn't an opener in a bullpen day. They went 2-3 in those ones. So even if you include those ones in the fifth rotation spot, they've gone 9-5, despite, I think, Easton Lucas went 5 innings twice. That's it. So bullpen days, they have navigated just so effectively.
Yeah, I mean, we may be seeing a bit of a rolling effect of that when you look at Brendan Little, for example.
Yes, and 31 pitches
that he delivered yesterday, and the fact that the Blue Jays have been using these guys a lot. we may start to see some fatigue. I don't want to alarm anyone, but it did look like Brendan Little was struggling a bit, especially with the knuckle curve when it comes to command.
Good time to have a Thursday and a Monday off in short order. You got a 3-game set against Philly. Yes, you'll need a bullpen day the following week, but you've got two starters you expect safely to give you length Friday and Sunday. You've got a Bowden Francis start that hopefully he gives you a little bit more length than last time. So you got bookended off days either way. Like, if you could get through this weekend series against Philly only using Brendan Little once, and he's only used one time in 5 days, you know, Hoffman maybe once, hope no more than twice. Obviously, you're not pitching him 3 days in a row, having just pitched 4 out of 5. The Brendan Little one was a little iffy there. He did strike 3 guys out in that inning, but 31 pitches to get through there with a walk and a hit. It was a little dicey command-wise. But the other guys were great.
The other guys were great, and I think we can kind of go in order here. Eric Lauer opened this one. Solid, I'd say. I'd say the one mistake was the Pozo home run, right?
Yeah, that was a bad... I would say he had 2 mistakes, and one of them was, like, he threw the ball away on a pickoff, and that extra base ended up costing him. I don't think the single would have scored the runner otherwise. And then, yeah, the pitch to Pozo was just a bad hanger.
There's nothing you can do. Those are going to happen, right? And if they don't happen often enough, then you can still keep your team sort of within striking distance, which was exactly what Lauer did. And frankly, exactly what his job was, right, at that point. We did see, I believe it was Fisher before Turnbull.
Yes, Fisher came in the fifth to get 2 outs, only threw 9 pitches. I thought he was going to come back out for the sixth just because he only threw 9 pitches. He's looked, we'll dig in on him more at some point in the future. He's been really good. I know he didn't have that great an outing in the one that he opened, but otherwise he's been really, really effective. Ben Clemens of Fangraphs wrote about him this week, actually. Ben Clemens, just full-time Jays writer now at Fangraphs, because this is what happens when things go well, is there are interesting things for national guys to write about. But yeah, so Fisher got the 2 outs and the 9 pitches, and then Spencer Turnbull made his Blue Jays debut.
That was 2 innings. He was good. I mean, you know, listen, we were all, I think, or most of us, bracing ourselves for the worst with all of the reports that we got, with the stats lines during his ramp-up period in the minor leagues. There were a lot of question marks. There was a lot that we didn't know about how Spencer Turnbull was going to look. And listen, could the velocity be in a bit of a better place? Yes, but we still saw an uptick.
Yeah.
And the breaking ball was fine. I mean, it was moving well.
I thought the sweeper was probably the most impressive part of it. Like, the fastball velocity still needs to come up a little bit more as he gets built up. I didn't think anything looked like, you know, too flashy or anything like that. But, yeah, the good break on the sweeper. And that's, I mean, for a first time out, given where the AAA outings had been and the complex leagues outings had been, that's fine. That's a good first step to build on from here, I think. And the fact that you only use him for 2 innings, if you have a mop up or a long man situation over the course of the weekend, think you could, I don't know if they'll do that or they'll try to keep him on, you know, piggybacked with Eric Lauer or whatever as they build him up. But yeah, pretty efficient 2 innings, and it was fine.
It was. Listen, yeah, maybe we see him again if things don't go so well for Bowden Francis, right? Maybe he is a guy who comes in bulk a little bit more. And it did look like Turnbull may come back out for another inning. Obviously, the Blue Jays didn't add any more runs, and so you really can't risk it at that point. And then we got closer Yariel.
Yes.
What was that experience like? So, we've been talking about this for so long.
Just one note. Jonah Bierenbaum, our pal at The Score, is listening and texting that Brendan Little has thrown the 9th most pitches in relief in baseball this year.
That is scary.
You want to talk fatigue units and stuff like that. That's a big one. And then, Yariel Rodriguez did not need a lot of pitches. 10 pitches, nasty 99 swing and miss to Lars Nootbaar to end the game. Yariel Rodriguez has allowed 2 runs over 19 innings in his last 14 appearances. I'm there. Like, I've been asking for more leverage Yari for the last little while. I'm there. You know, I know we had a text on question the other day about Hoffman and maybe turning down his leverage or whatever. I'm not as worried about that, but, like, there is no scenario in which I don't trust Yariel Rodriguez right now.
It's in the 2 runs, I assume, came in that home run that he allowed, which ended up not mattering because the Blue Jays, like, it's just, that to me is incredible because, one, he allowed a home run and then he came back out.
Yeah.
after the Blue Jays.
I honestly think that built more confidence for me in him in those spots than even yesterday's. Like, because yesterday's bottom 8-9-1 in the order, like whatever. Yeah. But yeah,
but maybe that is something that you know, you go back out and you get more outs and you actually allow your team to come back and win the game. Then maybe that was a bit of a hurdle for him to clear, and now it's like, yeah, you can close games, you can do whatever. Yeah. You're looking amazing, and clearly he was fired up. He was locked in. The 99 to end the game sort of just pointed to that, right? A guy who is really, really thriving in those big moments, and the moments keep getting bigger, and he keeps getting bigger too. It's amazing.
And like, he has experience in a leverage role back in Japan, but he was a setup man. He had zero saves and 28 holds in his last season there. He started the 2 years prior to that. So he did have a 1.15 ERA as a reliever his final year in Japan. So he's that's Japan. It's not apples to apples, but he's done that in a big leverage spot before, and I'm getting pretty confident. And it's interesting because, like, if Jimmy Garcia were healthy and Nick Sandlin were healthy and Jeff Hoffman looked a little better, you'd still be thinking of Yariel Rodriguez as a, could he give you two innings if Bowden Francis goes short? And now he's kind of
What a waste of Yariel Rodriguez that would be, right?
Yes, because he's playing, like, who knows? If, let's say it's 4-4 against the Phillies and you use him for two innings to get through 1-6 in their lineup in the fifth and sixth. That's maybe not that's a valuable one, but yeah, I want him seventh or later at this point, I think. And I think he's earned that with his performance.
You said that he didn't have any saves in Japan.
According to his Fangraphs stat line,
this was his first MLB save as well. So that's,
oh, I thought you were going to say he did have some in
no,
Japan.
No. Well, actually, no, I'm not like that. But yeah, it's kind of cool.
You can be like that. If you find something and have to correct me,
I'd be nicer about it. Though.
He had, what do you have? He had five saves scattered around a bunch of seasons in the Cuban National Series, but none in Japan, according to his baseball reference pages from his Japan years.
Yeah, this is a guy who's really figuring out who he is, who he wants to be, and just meeting the moment. It's cool, especially given how last year went with him. You know, there was just so much that we didn't know, and the starter experience.
It's like you went Cuba to Japan to Dominican Republic, missed a whole year, visa issues delayed your signing and all that stuff, and then you're a starter, you're a reliever, you're a AAA, you're the majors. Not surprising in retrospect that it took a little bit of time for him to get his footing.
Yeah.
But this is pretty fun. This is a fun version of Yariel Rodriguez.
Both feet on the ground, and the Blue Jays should have all the confidence in the world in him.
Yeah, it's fun. Again, two earned runs in his last 19 innings over 14 outings, and the Blue Jays now 7-2 in bullpen days. Pretty good stuff. Also exciting from the pitching side, Jacob Mizorowski is getting called up today by the Milwaukee Brewers. If you are a fantasy player, that is extremely relevant to you. If you are a Brewers fan, that is extremely relevant to you. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Derek Van Riper about that, and we'll kick it around all around baseball. But yeah, the headline, the Jays are off today, so the headline item for me is Miz Biz. Jacob Mizorowski is making that debut. We'll talk to him. We'll talk to John Morosi. We'll take your text to 590-590 later in the show as well. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Down in Milwaukee, there are a lot of transactions either happening or going to happen in July sometimes if I have my way. That is a basketball-related comment. But today, we will see their top pitching prospect, Jacob Mizorowski, called up to start for the Brewers. Let's talk about it. We're joined now by Derek Van Riper of The Athletic, of Rates and Barrels. Derek, good morning, man. How you doing?
Good morning. Good to see both of you. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. This is a terrific backdrop, by the way. I assume it's faux brick. It's not actually exposed brick behind you, but it makes for a good shot.
Just a panel held up with some nails. Yeah, I got to decorate it. I actually just moved into a new place and have nothing on the walls yet. So at least it's not a bare white wall.
Yeah, it looks great. Bare white wall's fine. It reminds me of when Ross Atkins was like secretly meeting with Shohei Ohtani and canceled the winter meeting availability and was like, the shot was like this narrow, so you couldn't tell where he was.
Yeah. That's good way to protect your location there, Derek. Very elegant.
All right, Derek, big day for Brewers fans as well as fantasy baseball players. Jacob Mizorowski, one of the most interesting pitching prospects in all of baseball, getting called up. Obviously, very nasty stuff, big strikeout rates, few little concerns under the hood. How are you feeling big picture on Mizorowski getting the call today?
Well, so the scouting report on Mizorowski has always been high-end reliever risk, which is still pretty good risk, right? You're a big leaguer. You're going to pitch in the eighth, the ninth inning because he's got a triple digits fastball. He's touched 103 this year. Wipeout slider. The secondaries have come along pretty well this year. He's got a changeup that he sort of found at Nashville, a new grip that's worked really well for him. The models like the pitch too, so it's always good to get that sort of backup. But he likes the feel of that pitch. So now we're talking about more of a four-pitch guy at 6'7" with top-end velocity. The big misses are something they've cited that have improved at AAA. Like, he's got below-average command, but by the location numbers we have through Enoceris's stuff model, we actually see some improvements in that regard as well. So I think what you're looking at with Mizorowski, maybe a 30% strikeout rate in the big leagues in the long run, but one of those guys that also runs like a 10 to 12% walk rate, and whether or not it works really well as a starter is going to come down to durability. He's 6'7", listed at like 180 pounds, looks kind of like one of those wacky waving inflatable tube guys they put out in front of the car dealership. But I imagine that's a really tough at bat for righties in particular. You get 6'7" with that kind of extension and that velocity, he's going to be a problem. And I like that they're throwing him right to the fire with a tough matchup against the Cardinals. It's a home matchup, but you know, throw him into a rivalry, just see how he does right away.
Yeah, it's great. You mentioned the size and the limbs. Like, it is, you watch the video or you see the still frames and it looks like we'll see how the arm angle stuff and the release point, like, I know we can see that for AAA stuff, but we can see it a little better, a little bit higher fidelity at the major league level. It has just got to be so funky to hit off of 6'7" with these long, skinny arms. And then it just kind of, like, it's 100 that explodes at you because of how unconventional the levers are, I guess, for lack of a better term, for a 6'7" skinny guy like that. Derek, from a fantasy perspective, I was pretty aggressive. I think I spent like 15% of my remaining free agent dollars to grab him. It's a league without many minors stashed, so he was available. From that perspective, obviously the long-term outlook, if he's a starter, if he's a reliever, short-term, where's your confidence level starting him in a matchup like the Cardinals, or even, you know, being pretty aggressive to add him at least until the league's seen him a little bit?
I think you want to take the chance. I mean, look, if it doesn't work out, if the command slips and he's going two or three innings and getting knocked around, you have to live with that as one of the outcomes, because the possibility of getting five plus innings from him on a start-by-start basis is actually there. We know the Brewers do a good job putting all of their pitchers in the right roles. They're not going to overexpose a rookie. They're not going to overexpose someone that works in bulk. They have a good game plan, right? So I think you pair all these factors together. So if you spent 15% of a budget on him, maybe it's only 7 or 8 starts before he does shift into a bullpen role eventually. If they're protecting his innings, they might be 7 or 8 really good starts. I think it's a gamble worth taking, and pitching so hard to find on the waiver wire, I think you want to play more for the ceiling than for those median outcomes anyway.
Derek, it's funny that you mentioned, you know, how the Brewers, I guess, utilize certain players in certain situations, and I wonder how much the organization goes into your evaluation for fantasy purposes. You know, obviously your familiarity with the Brewers, I guess, helps with that. But how much does that go into it?
It's a huge thing for me. I look at teams like the Dodgers, the Rays, the Guardians, the Brewers, the ones that have good reputations for adding pitches, finding location strategies that work, not overexposing guys that really struggle the third time through the order. And some of these teams find guys seemingly out of nowhere. You think of Tobias Myers last year. You think of Chad Patrick this year. I know he just got knocked around by Atlanta on Wednesday, but like, to find and develop players like that just changes your overall assessment of just about anybody they bring in. You have to have a little bit of belief that they know what to do to make guys succeed. And then you bring in higher end talent, the top prospects, it just feels like the ceiling is higher than it is for other organizations.
You mentioned the Rays. They're obviously a good example. I don't exactly know what the weight is on Ian Seymour, but other than that, I'm with you on that one. With the Brewers in general, this isn't Mizorowski specific, kind of hanging around 500 in a pretty strong National League. I know you guys started to do on Rates and Barrels this week, you know, checking in on who might be the buyers and sellers, and obviously we're a little further away from that. But given the top heaviness of the National League. How interesting a question is that for you? Four teams like the Brewers, even the Cardinals, as they slide back down to earth a little bit. Like, it's an interesting year where 500-ish might not really cut it in the National League come late July.
Yeah, it really depends on what happens with the teams in the NL West, especially, right? I mean, I think as they see more of each other, maybe their records will sink back closer to the pack and things will level out a little bit. But I do think there's a clear, like, top tier and second tier right now in the NL. And the Brewers, I think, are a second tier team. I think there are a couple of holes in the roster that they need to address. But the thing that they have that a lot of teams looking to buy don't necessarily have is they have some pitching depth, including starters. I mean, Aaron Civale's in the bullpen. He's at least interesting to teams that want a fourth or a fifth starter. They have a lot of prospects that have moved up organizational prospect rankings, all the industry-wide stuff. Like, they're popping in that regard. So they have talent to move and things that other teams want. Third base, this looks like the most obvious area of upgrade. If they can actually find a fit on another roster that makes sense, and it could be more of a multi-year solution too if they can work out a big trade.
Yeah, that's third base has somehow become like a fairly weak position around base. Like, everyone seems to be okay at shortstop, and third base is the is the whole spot now. The Jays have found it a little bit with the Barger breakout and Ernie Clement looking pretty good. But yeah, you look around the league and there are a lot of Caleb Durbins around the league, you know. So I want to back to the prospect idea. This is so Jacob Mizrowski's coming up, and we talked about his value and the ceiling play is there. The Red Sox have called up a trio of prospects, and Marcelo Meyer had a pair of home runs last night. Roman Anthony has, you know, cold first series or whatever. Christian Campbell's just kind of been okay. This is not necessarily specific to those three guys and Mizrowski, but as a fantasy strategy in general, how do you balance these guys are going to come up and they're going to be buzzy and people are excited about them, but especially on the position player side, they might not be that impactful out of the gate. Like, with a Roman Anthony or a Marcelo Meyer type guy, are you in the camp of try to acquire them, but then they're going to have a good trade value for a little while there? How do you handle that type of guy?
Yeah, so in redraft leagues, I think the cost of adding those guys in season is significant. Like, Jack Caglione, Roman Anthony, those players are going to cost a third or more of your fab budget in competitive leagues. So you're going to take opportunities to upgrade your roster elsewhere if you take a swing like that. Who the player is probably dictates whether or not I actually take that chance. For Jack Caglione, who are the Royals going to replace him with? That looks like a really safe situation. For Roman Anthony, even though I think he might be the better long-term player, they have more of a crowd there. We were talking about how crowded that depth chart was back in March, and other than the Willier Abreu injury, nothing's changed. They haven't made a trade yet. So there's always the possibility that Roman Anthony is okay, not great, or struggles and just gets sent back down to AAA once Willier Abreu's healthy, because they want him to continue playing every day. So for me, it comes down to overall needs on my roster. I'm more likely to take those chances now with pitchers than hitters. I feel like the information we get about pitching coming out of the minor leagues gives us a little more confidence in what we're going to get upon arrival. I think because a lot of times pitchers are coming up to replace someone who got hurt with a long-term injury, you have a better runway for playing time as well. So that seems like a slightly safer method. But like, historically, the return on investment for in-season pickups of rookies is generally not good.
Yeah.
It's just sort of a boom-bust sort of thing, almost like trying to save a roster. If you're fourth or fifth place and you need that extra spark, then it's a chance it's worth taking. Otherwise, it actually ends up being fab wasted in many cases.
And then you have a guy like Mick Abel, right, yeah, who seems to now be in line for a bit of a longer look.
Yeah, with the Aaron Nola uncertainty.
Yeah, rib cage, stress reaction, whatever it is, I think he's supposed to be out until the All-Star break. It was kind of a weird one where Abel came up. He did great, got sent back down, which is, you know, it's kind of refreshing to see the Brewers call up a guy who has earned it, who has proved everything that there's to prove at AAA, and then now here he is. But with Abel and just the way that the Phillies have utilized him so far, how does that play into your evaluation here?
Yeah, Abel ended up being, I think, relatively inexpensive when he came up because of the uncertainty. I think the weekend he debuted, he got picked up and was sent down like right after everybody spent their money. So it was kind of a strange timeline for him. But I think Abel's a good example of the types of rookies that make more sense to bid on in general, like the guys that are a little less expensive, because their opportunities could be just as long as the more highly regarded guys. And a lot of times, Abel's not a necessary example of this, but older rookies, are also extremely valuable. And guys that have maybe a half season of experience scattered over parts of two seasons, up and down guys. I mean, you mentioned Addison Barger earlier. He's never really had a prolonged opportunity to have a spot to call his own. Now he does. And I think those types of players, either former prospects or guys that come up a little bit unexpectedly, end up being the better values overall.
And Abel's an interesting one, too, even right now. So you mentioned he came up, he had that banger of a start against the Pirates and then went back down. So maybe he got re-added to the available player pool for you. And then his first two starts back up were he actually pitched pretty well against the Jays, but the Jays have been one of the hottest offenses. And then he got the Cubs, who have been the best offense in baseball other than maybe the Dodgers. So like if the optimism has cooled off a little bit on Mick Abel because he hasn't had an awesome first two starts back up, I don't know, little opportunity there. It's going to get easier than Jays and Cubs from here, I think. It won't all be Pirates. They can't all be Pirates, but it might be a little easier there. Derek, I want to ask you, this is, again, kind of a bigger philosophical thing, but you had a really great post on Blue Sky the other day about Tarek Skubal, and it was interesting for me to sit with it and think about it. And you said, your favorite way to be wrong is to underestimate elite players, believing we've seen the ceiling, only to learn that we were still on our way to the ceiling. Now, Tarek Skubal is obviously an extreme example, but I kind of want to give you space to expand on that a little bit more. And, you know, that experience of you, we so often talk about like an upside as if it's like a fixed upside is like, will he get to this point? I don't know. How do we know when, like, how do you know it's Tarek Skubal and there's more of an upside there? It's a fascinating thing to think about that some, like Aaron Judge, we thought last year and the 61 homer year was like maybe the ceiling. And now he's like, no, man, I'm going to do that for like 200 games and have a Barry Bonds level 200 games. I don't know. I've sat with that for a couple days since you posted it, just kind of thinking about what do we make of that? Who's the next Tarek Skubal that we don't even want to put a ceiling on when the ceiling that it looks like is Cy Young?
Yeah, I was just starting to think about who's the next Skubal. Who's the guy right now that has a home run problem and runs a 4 ERA in a pitcher-friendly park and is just a good young pitcher that might have a bright future, but certainly is not someone anyone's going out there and saying is going to win a Cy Young or multiple Cy Youngs. I mean, that's the pace Tarek Skubal's on right now. He might win another one. And I think what I was thinking about was I've done fantasy analysis since, geez, like 2006 now. So I played for a long time. And I think my brain gets locked into these patterns where I see a peak of $30 value, $35 value, whatever the top seems like it is. And when a player hits that, you're like, okay, there's not really any more levels they can reach. And sometimes at Ronald Acuna Jr. a few years ago, right? I mean, he put together one of the best seasons we've ever seen offensively. I just think it's a fun way to be wrong because it's sort of like the Shohei Ohtani effect in other players. Like, I think a couple of years ago, I got to the point where I just said, just never doubt Shohei Ohtani. There's nothing this guy can't do on a baseball field. If you think you've seen it all, you haven't. But that applies to other players, too. Skubal was just one of those examples that I thought back to like 2 or 3 years ago. I was like, yeah, he's a good pitcher, good ballpark, guy I like to watch, but I never thought he'd be this good. And when last year happened, I traded him in a keeper league. I was out of contention. I traded him for Bryce Harper. I got older in a keeper league, thinking I was making the smart, safe move. And obviously finding an ace is impossible, so that move backfired. But it's a fun way to be wrong, even though being wrong always sucks.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, you look at the leaders then, like, who has the highest strikeout rate but a high home run per fly ball rate and the ERAs? And it's like, even if you really like a guy, even if you think Ben Brown is sick, you can't, like, I just can't bring my head to be like, yeah, maybe he could take the Tarek Skubal jump, because nobody takes the Tarek Skubal jump except one guy, Luis Ortiz, 2 years from now, will take a Tarek Skubal jump or something like that. It's so fascinating to kick around because there's almost no way to know. We knew Skubal from the underlings and stuff like that was like good, but you don't know what's going to unlock and turn a guy from really good or potentially really good into potentially the best pitcher in baseball or the best hitter in baseball. It's crazy.
Is it a little bit easier, I guess, to project who the next Mizrowski would be rather than who the next Tarek
Skubal
would be?
Like, call-up-wise?
Yeah, right on. Like, okay, the next one to make the impact, right?
Yeah, I think that ends up being a little easier. You get more indicators of what teams are looking for in minor league performances, and I think you can make a nice Fangraphs leaderboard and kind of work through that and look at how the back end of the rotation lines up, figure out where the weaknesses are. Like, I feel like that's a strength for me, but finding the next Tarek Skubal, I wish I could do it.
Yeah, I mean, if you could do it, you would be working for a Major League Baseball team instead of being one of the best fantasy analysts out there. You've got a pretty good position now, but yeah, if you were, hey, that guy's going to be Tarek Skubal, you'd be on the team side. We wouldn't be able to get you on the show. One name that I wanted to ask you about, and this is, I'm not saying he's going to be Tarek Skubal, but it's an upside play in the spirit of what you were talking about with Mizorowski, where the ceiling, if you can get a guy who runs off 7 or 8 big starts in the second half of the season, that the value of that is just so huge. So I'm wondering where you're at on Yuri Perez, who just came back, 22 years old, long time down with injuries, made like 8 rehab starts on his way building back up and didn't have a very good first outing, but the stuff is just crazy. I don't know if he can locate. It's like, it's kind of like if Mizorowski were coming back from injury on top of everything else. Where are you on Yuri Perez for the rest of the season?
I'm actually pretty high on him. I do think there's probably an age component to recovering from major surgery, and Yuri Perez being a lot younger, he's 22, I think that bodes really well for his chances. I think we're seeing it with the velocity, right? He was touching 99 in that first start back. He threw the fastball a lot, like 61% compared to 45% during his rookie season. The secondaries are different. The curveball has more depth now. The slider is good. I think he's a more complete pitcher than many pitchers his age. We were saying that about him when he arrived. So relative to other guys coming off of Tommy John surgery, I am more optimistic about Yuri. I think the park and the way they've sort of carefully brought him along through rehab leaves a lot of innings for him in the second half of the season. It's important for him beyond this year to work like a regular starter the rest of the way, get up to his innings cap, and then be ready to go full bore again in 2026.
Yeah, and he's eligible in 2027, so you know the Marlins will have him on the market within like the next 18 months as well. Derek, before I let you go, the last name I want to ask you about, and sorry I didn't give you this one ahead of time, but I'm sure you've thought about it. We heard earlier this week that Ben Kasparis' next outing will be as a starter. I don't know if that's going to be permanent or if it's just a spot start. The Dodgers rotation is so hard to figure out. Is there juice there for you with Kasparis, or is the changing role and the fact that he's not a safe bet to be the pitcher of record all that often, like, is that too murky for you?
No, because as we've seen with the Dodgers, it's a house of cards health-wise on the rotation side. I want to be optimistic about Glasnow and Snell and the final stages of Ohtani's recovery as a pitcher. And the odds of all three of those guys coming back and staying healthy, and then the guys that are currently in the rotation also staying healthy, is low enough where I think if Ben Kasparis pitches well, considering that the Dodgers often use 6 starters anyway, he can continue working as a starter. And I think relative to more highly regarded prospects, he'll fall into that bucket of a less expensive pickup in leagues where he's available. So I'll take the chance. And again, it's the desperation for quality innings too. Even if it's only a handful of starts, I need those handful of starts.
Yeah, Brandon
you
Font
and the
has,
Dodgers both.
Yeah, you and the Dodgers both. And yeah, Shohei getting the 2 and 3 innings is weirdly like
Here's
not
another name, another yeah, interesting fantasy name. And right? Shohei Ohtani, the starter.
Yeah, and like it's interesting, like obviously there are multiple formats where sometimes if you own Shohei the hitter, you get the pitcher stats. Sometimes he's two different players. But if he's only going to go 2 or 3 innings, you can't get a win. So like it's that's a fascinating one. Are you I've gotten to a place where like at least like this season, I don't own any Shohei pitcher shares because like who knew the timeline and he probably can't get a win and stuff like that. Are you holding any Shohei as a pitcher?
I've got him in Tout Wars. It's a 15 team mixed league, unlimited IL. So the bench gets pretty big. The weird thing is because he's actually healthy as a hitter, he doesn't have an IL designation. So I do have to burn a bench spot. But that was the only format where I felt like it wasn't going to hurt me to wait and see what we'd actually get from him. And you're probably right. I mean, it might take 2 months before he's pitching deep enough into outings where he's win eligible, unless they throw an opener in front of him or something like that. But I think that'd be kind of a strange thing to do with Shohei Ohtani.
Yeah, I would imagine it would disrupt his like hitting prep and things like that. Like I can't even imagine what it's like to do both of those things in the same game at the same level. But yeah, not knowing when you're coming in and having to be like warming up while you're also hitting could be just a little too weird. That format sounds awesome. Some of the like big Tout War stuff is like we're technically not eligible here in Ontario. Like we're not allowed to sign up. We can't use our credit cards and things like that. So I don't get to be in the big fancy ones. I am in a league with Eno though, and he's doing Eno things at the top. So take him down a peg for me, buddy.
Will do.
All right, Derek. Thanks so much for doing this, man. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Derek Van Riper of The Athletic, of Rates and Barrels. You can check that out a couple times a week. It's one of the, if you are an analytics-leaning baseball fan, if you are a big fantasy player, if you just want to hear hitter and pitcher perspectives on all this, they have Jed Lowry and Trevor May on regularly, so you get a hitter's perspective, a pitcher's perspective, two pretty data-friendly guys. Trevor May has been on our show in the past as well. But yeah, probably my number one non-Sportsnet baseball show is what I will.
It is actually really good. It's a good listen and pretty dynamic stuff. And
yeah, and Eno and I go way back, so it's nice to see. It's nice to hear, you know, his take on stuff. Yeah. And then Derek just has like the best podcast voice imaginable.
I know, it's so soothing. So yeah, it's a good listen for sure.
All right, we are going to take a break. In the second hour, we're going to take some of your texts. You can text us to 590-590. Standard data and message rates may apply. We already have a bunch going on there, but we'll do that around 11:30, so keep them coming. Your questions, your thoughts, how are you feeling about the Jays 12-2 stretch? How are you feeling about Julia fake typing on her laptop as we head to break? After this break, though, we'll talk to John Morosi of MLB Network. He will be in Kansas City for Yankees-Royals tonight, a little ALDS rematch. We'll talk about it. We'll see if he's believing on these Blue Jays as well. John Morosi joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. Tonight, we'll see if Aaron Judge can top a 470-foot homer that felt like 500 feet the other day. It's a MLB Network showcase game tonight. It's Yankees-Royals. It's a little ALDS rematch. It's an important one for the Yankees because the Blue Jays have won 12 of 14 and are not on their tails yet, but making it interesting in the American League East. Let's see how John Morosi of MLB Network is feeling about it. John, good morning. Thank you for doing this.
Blake and Julia, my pleasure. Great to be with you. And actually, I just saw the home run that Judge hit. It landed in the parking lot just across there as we were getting ready to begin this segment. My goodness, Aaron Judge, it was interesting. I just wrapped up my segment on MLB Network this morning. What do we say about it? What more can we say? And where I landed on that is this, that no player ever who has had a 60-homer season has also won a triple crown.
Oh.
And Aaron Judge could change that this year. No one has ever done it. The list of 60-homer seasons, of course, is quite short. The list of triple crowns is quite short. And Aaron Judge could be the one man who is able
There's your Venn diagram right there. It's Aaron Judge.
He is a truly, Julia, he is a one of one.
It is like
incredible.
He's hit 25 home runs this year, which, great. Only Cal Raleigh has more. He's second in the league in home runs. He's got 59 RBI. Awesome. The Triple Crown stuff, like, those two-thirds of it are cool. He's hitting .394. He has the highest batting average on balls in play right now since the 1800s. And, like, some of that is like, okay, that'll come back down to earth. No one except for Tyler Heineman has a .500 batting average on balls in play. But I actually believe it with Judge because everything he hits is a laser and either bounces off the wall or the one time he doesn't lift it in the air is a line drive right over the second. It's incredible, John.
Will it come back down? We actually don't. Yeah, we can't be sure that it'll come back down.
It's hard to say. So, John, I mean, like, we've known about the power from Aaron Judge for years now. How impressed are you by the jump that he's taken as an everything? I was going to say contact hitter, but an everything hitter. Like, he's hitting .394, and it's June 12th.
Like, that is the point. And first of all, credit to Tyler Heineman for being part of the same sentence that you just said of Aaron Judge. Well done there, Tyler, in a great year with the Jays. But you're right. I think that it was interesting. I checked in with one of Aaron's friends yesterday just to say, what more can I offer on this? And he basically said, John, you have to realize he's just never satisfied. The way that he works in the winter, the way that he works through the season is emblematic of someone that is already great and is entirely focused on getting just a few percentage points better every day. And when you constantly do that, little bit by little bit, when you're already starting at a very high spot on the mountain, pretty soon you've ascended Everest. And that's basically what Aaron Judge is doing right now from a baseball perspective. And by the way, the home run that for our viewers on the TV side who are seeing the replay of Aaron's home run earlier in the week, when even the dugout of Aaron's teammates are just totally stupefied at what they saw, and they're used to seeing this every day. And that one went off the Royals Hall of Fame and left field at Kauffman Stadium, which again is just a massive shot. We're seeing next level from Aaron Judge right now. And remember the context in which he's doing this too. There's no Juan Soto in this lineup any longer. And there's no Giancarlo Stanton, who was such a huge part of what they did, especially last year down the stretch and into the postseason. So he's doing this. He's not doing it by himself, but he is the single driving force. And he's not someone, you think about guys that have made a run for 400, and George Brett did it certainly in Kansas City, getting very close about 40 years ago. There were at least some infield hits there. With Aaron, it's not as though he's beating out ground balls to the left side and just barely getting hits the way that Ichiro did when he was winning batting titles. It's a different player that is just doing it all. And I always want us to make sure that we're bearing this in mind when you're watching a Connor McDavid in the Stanley Cup final, when you're watching someone like Judge right now. We're in this kind of quick take world. You got to just stand back and watch it, because you're watching an all-time great that you want to be able to tell your grandkids one day, hey, not only did I watch Aaron Judge or McDavid, but I was taking the time to appreciate it while it was happening. And so my advice to everybody is put your cell phones down, just watch the game, and appreciate what Aaron Judge is doing.
We can't do that tonight, though, because those guys are playing at the same time. The MLB Network Showcase game is head-to-head against
the... Yeah, so there's got to be a way, Blake and Julia. We got to be clever about this. Now, absolutely. I guess
Sportsnet Plus is a wonderful service. You can watch them both at once.
Good advertisement there for Sportsnet Plus. Will I occasionally take a glance at my phone to see what's going on in the hockey game? Maybe, even though I'm working the broadcast for MLB Network. That's off the record, just between us. Don't tell anybody that I said that, but I may take a glance or two at my phone while we're doing the
baseball
game.
But listen, John, never during Aaron Judge at-bats, right?
No, that's, no, no.
That's
not
the
during
thing.
Judge at-bats. Yeah, and there's a little thing, too. This is like producing, as both of you know, when you're talking about a game. Never is a strong word in television. I will never tell our producer, Bill Boland, that I have a story to tell while Judge is coming up to bat. So anything that I say about Judge will be, hey, let's do it. Let's do it well. He's in the field during the bottom third of the Royals lineup. That's when I will tell any Aaron Judge stories that I have to tell. Not when he's batting. They don't want to hear from them. They're not tuning in to hear from me when number 99 is at the batter's box.
Oh, that's perfect. That's such a good way to look at it, John. And listen, you mentioned that there's, I guess, little or less protection around Judge this year. And it's kind of silly to think about the season that he's putting together and the fact that this division is still very much within reach for a team like the Blue Jays. Are we believing that the Blue Jays can actually make a run for the AL East here?
They certainly can. And they're, I would say that a wild card probably is more likely.
Yeah.
And yet, the Yankees have some rotation concerns and have worked through them. I think with the Jays, the way that Lauer has emerged has been, I think, one of the most important parts of the Jays story and is the reason why. And I was listening last night to Blair and Barker after the game, the fact that they now have the third best record in the American League. This is a big story. The Jays have become one in the course of the American League so far this season. I do believe that the Jays have a legitimate chance to chase down the Yankees in the American League East. And here's the biggest reason why, is that we have not yet seen the very best from the Jays' very best players. There's still some room to grow. And again, it's probably asking a lot for Heinemann to continue that batting average balls in play or what Clement has been able to do. I'm a big fan of what Barger has done, emerging as a really nice everyday player, one of the better young players in the American League, candidly, that are 25 and younger. But I think you look at the big picture here of this Jays lineup, and certainly you hope for more from Santander in the second half. You hope for more from Bo and Vlad as well. Varsho, you hope, obviously, for health and production. This is a good lineup, a good, maybe even a very good lineup once you get all these pieces going together. And I think in the bullpen, we have seen some emerging late inning leverage arms that are able to help Hoffman settle into what he's been able to do. Yadiel Rodriguez, I think he's a story, the stuff that he has shown just even in this series. So I'm encouraged by the Jays overall. This looks like a playoff team in any year. based on just the makeup of the roster and the way they're performing, but especially in the American League in 2025, where the Red Sox are down, the Rays are good but not great, the Royals, who we're going to see here this week, good but not great. The Tigers are excellent, but again, the Astros have come down a little bit. The Mariners are a team that is more flawed than I thought they were. The Jays have to just keep playing the way they're playing, and they will be a playoff team in 2025.
It's interesting, those AL Central teams, other than the Tigers coming back down to earth. And again, you'll get a good look at the Royals on the MLB Network Showcase game tonight. Aaron Judge against Bobby Witt Jr. is pretty cool. Aaron Judge, it's not going to be as close to MVP race. And if it is, it'll be Cal Raleigh, not Bobby Witt Jr. in there. Also a fun pitching matchup, Will Warren against Seth Lugo. So kind of the young, like, stuff guy versus the savvy old vet. So all that stuff's cool. But what have you made of where the Royals are generally? Obviously, Bobby Witt Jr. is amazing, and some of the stuff they built last year is still there. This is an ALDS rematch here. But it really does feel like those three teams in the Central are just kind of okay after the Tigers.
They are. And I think that you can make an argument, and the Twins, by the way, with that really hot stretch they had to vault themselves back into contention. I really thought around the start of that period of time was when they lost Pablo Lopez for a long-term injury. And I thought, my goodness, they're going to have to be sellers now at the deadline. But they've done a really good job of stabilizing their season. I think with the Royals, they're not necessarily missing as many bats in the rotation as you would like to see. And Lugo has given up more homers than you would expect. I think that's maybe one concerning thing to watch here in the game tonight and as a long-term trend. Sal Perez has taken a bit of a step back, too. I think last year, the thing you liked a lot about that lineup, and I remember because I worked the division series last year between these teams and was studying these teams a lot, I said, wow, the Royals, their chance to maybe get past the Yankees is that they've got Witt playing like an MVP, Sal Perez had a really good year, and then Pasquantino. But Pasquantino was hurt last year during the division series. It wasn't really 100%. And then now this season, Sal has taken a bit of a step back. They call up Caglione, hoping that he's going to give them a bit of a jolt. Hasn't materialized yet. Just let him settle in. I think I'm a big believer in the bat and the athleticism. But there's just not quite as much that I'm seeing in this lineup that really scares you. Although Michael Garcia has taken a bit of a step. There was a back and forth with him and Jazz Chisholm during the earlier part of the series, a little tension there. But I think the general story of Michael Garcia has been more production out of him. I remember I talked to George Brett last year, and George said that Michael Garcia, he tells him all the time that he's his favorite player on the Royals. He plays third base, of course, too, so there's a little bit of a connection there. But if George Brett believes in you, I'm inclined to believe in you. And Michael Garcia has taken that next step forward this season. So I think a lot to like about the way this team has come together, but I'm still waiting to see that additional layer of production. The outfield isn't terribly productive in terms of home run power, and I think that we're seeing a bit of a gap now between the depth of the Tigers lineup and the depth of the other lineups in the American League Central.
John, you hinted at the trade deadline a couple of times here. And, you know, as we're watching Bowden Francis struggle and as we don't know what to expect from Max Scherzer, Blue Jays probably still looking for a bat, right? We start to tune into those things. How is it shaping up? I know it's still early, but what are you seeing in the early going here? I know you've posted about that a little bit these days.
Yeah. Yeah, Julia, this is kind of the time, right? We're midway through June, and if not heavy conversations, at least the lay of the land. And what I think is important to point out is that because the American League has so much parity, there are very few teams that are obvious sellers right now in the AL. Now, the Rangers are a team that Chris Young is very aggressive. They're probably going to wait on declaring themselves to be sellers, but if they do, Tyler Mahle, Patrick Corbin in the rotation are names to watch. Hobie Milner in the bullpen. I think that's a really interesting potential seller. Not there yet. Zach Littell is a name that I shared yesterday. I think he is someone that I'm watching carefully because we have seen the Rays, even when they're not necessarily a clear seller, they will sell. They'll buy and sell simultaneously. And it seems quite clear to me that the Rays, when you've got a pitcher in the final year of his contract, they very rarely will let that pitcher walk with getting nothing back for him. That was the case with Aaron Civale before. You go way back, David Price certainly was part of that conversation. And even in the case of Price, it was a year and a half. So the Rays, even when they're in it, will often listen. and they have to just because of the way they do business. And for that reason, Zach Littell is maybe not a huge name, but he's someone that I believe would have a lot of value. And again, the Jays will probably take some time, Julia, to assess exactly what's going on. What can they expect out of Max Scherzer? I think we're about to find out in the next couple of weeks. Take your time, figure out where you're at, and then proceed accordingly. The Dodgers, by the way, making some similar decisions right now in their own way. Shohei should be able to come back and pitch around the middle part of the year. They believe the same is true for Snell. They believe the same is true for Glasnow. They just moved Ben Kasperis into the rotation. Their needs and their want to acquire pitching will become clear. So I think the thesis I have here, Julia, is that there should be some arms out there, but maybe not abundantly now. That it's probably going to be closer to the middle part of July. This feels to me like the time to assess and kind of really vet out what you've got internally. And I think for the Jays, see how much you can get out of Scherzer. See how deep can Lauer go into games if you make him a more or less full-time member of the rotation. I think there have been some really good unsung heroes in this Jays pitching staff so far. And I would also say, you know, Yadier Rodriguez certainly has been someone that's been able to start games in the past. I like him right where he is. I think you keep him in the bullpen. He has shown himself to be a trustworthy leverage arm. And when you get someone like that, keep him right where he's at and find different ways to get the lead to him, whether it's the seventh or the eighth or the ninth.
Well, here's the thing. First of all, you'd have to stretch him back out to get him to start because he's only worked one or two innings. But if you did that, then immediately you're looking for a leverage arm.
Yeah, your bullpen is thin.
but it's interesting the way you lay that out in two respects, John. And one is that, like, we get a lot of questions. Why aren't they addressing this yet? They know this is going to be a need, but you just laid it out. There are a lot of teams that are potential sellers that are still figuring it out and figuring out if they are going to be sellers. So you need a trade partner. And we know the Rockies are bad, but they don't have any interesting players to trade you.
Correct.
And they'll never trade Ryan McMahon. He'll be 50 years old and still in that lineup. The other part is like all 162 games are created equal when the final standings are set. However, the Jays going on this 12-2 run now and giving themselves a little bit of breathing room, giving themselves a little, you know, you're not three games out of a playoff spot in July. You don't have to be looking, should we sell? You're like pretty clearly in buyer mode, and you've given yourself, you use the word patience and kind of, you know, figure out exactly, like you can slow play it and see, is Scherzer going to be enough and we should focus on one more bat? Is Scherzer not, and Lauer, you know, it's not going to work out. We have to do what we have with the offense, and we have to go and get a number one starter. We have to hope the Diamondbacks fall out of it, and Zach Gallen's available or something like that.
That's an interesting name right there.
Yeah, so it's by him. There is a value, even though the 12 wins will count as 12 wins at the end, there's a value in having this heater right now in terms of how the next couple weeks looks for you. Do you think that's fair to say?
I do, Blake, and it's an excellent point. What it does, it buys you time and it buys you leverage when you're playing well. You're not desperate. And I think the Jays, full credit to them, are in a position where, yes, they could add in multiple areas of their club, but they're not desperate right now. They're not in a panic state. And when you are able to make a clear-eyed assessment of things without rushing into a move, you tend to make better trades. And you tend to make better decisions. And I think that also the other piece of this equation, and I don't have a name in mind right now that I'm thinking of necessarily, but when you have a player like Lauer come in and have success and sort of put himself back into the starting conversation, it reflects well on the organization, such that when you have a player with a July 1 opt-out or a June 15 opt-out, or obviously June 1 has passed, but there are players in the minor leagues who are performing and maybe they're looking for an opportunity. The Jays can say, listen, sign with us, look at what we're doing, look at the success that we've got with players working with Pete Walker and becoming better versions of themselves. You can come here, get better, help us win games, and then when you're a free agent after the season, you'll go out and make a lot of money, whether it's with us or somebody else. This is a mutually beneficial relationship. And the Tigers have done a very good job of that, by the way. You think about Jack Flaherty. They signed him. He had a great first half. They traded him to the Dodgers, wins a World Series. He comes back in free agency. He's helping him be in first place now. It's been a good relationship. And I think that teams and agents want to know that when I call you, and that there's a potential connection there, that my guy is going to go to you and get better. Think of it as like pitching graduate school. Professor Walker's done a pretty good job. And that I think is something that's going to be a really key element in the Jays' ability to court pitchers in the future.
So my mind goes to the Dodgers, which has been sort of an opposite conversation here, John. And, to the extent that you feel comfortable, I do want to get you to weigh in on this, because we have spoken a little bit of can this run of injuries and the fact that they can't seem to just keep pitchers healthy affect them in recruiting free agents and players in the future. And then you look at what the Blue Jays have done with a lot of these guys who kind of just have a renaissance here. I don't know. I'm not saying I'm thinking of Roky Sasaki specifically, but, where do you stand on that?
Yeah, it's a great point. And by the way, I was listening to the show last week when you were talking about the Roky Sasaki, Miles Straw conversation. Again, look at the analytics.
Yep.
Miles Straw has a greater WAR this year than Roky Sasaki. Just making the point. That you could, as they say, you can look it up. That is a true fact. So with the Dodgers, Julia, it's an excellent point. They're a team that certainly their financial wherewithal and playing in L.A., the perpetual chance to make the playoffs, there's a lot of reasons people like playing there. And I think that they will have a certain advantage insofar as their financial advantage is real and people want to play there. They take very good care of their players in a lot of different ways. But I look at it as probably as much of an issue on the Dodgers side of things of why do we keep bringing in pitchers with big time stuff who then break down? Yamamoto has power stuff, but he's not always throwing with a maximum effort. And the general way in which Yamamoto operates is under control. When you see him on the mound, it's not just command of the pitches, but just command of everything. He understands his body, moves very well within space. And I think there's a lot of pitchers that they're drawn to who throw really hard and then break. And that's eventually, this is not just a one-year thing. Last year it was obviously the case. And if they hadn't have found a way to get past the Padres in game four, who knows what would have happened to the overall leadership of the club at that point. So it's something the Dodgers have to deal with. They're having to go to openers, Julia, way too often. There's no way that a team with blessed with that level of investment and payroll and resources should be having to do this. And yet it's proof positive that in the modern game, if you're constantly bringing in pitchers with mega stuff, they're going to break down eventually. And when it happens all at the same time, you're in a panic. And that's exactly where the Dodgers are. The way that now, and I spoke with a high-ranking Dodger official last week when I was there, and he basically said, the reason why we added so much pitching in the offseason, including Roky, including Blake Snell, was the idea that they wanted to avoid having to make a trade like the Flaherty move a year ago. And if they hadn't gotten Flaherty from the Tigers, they would not have been in the World Series, period. He helped them get there, and he soaked up a lot of really important innings. Their belief is that with some combination of Ohtani and Snell and Glasnow and Emmett Sheehan, a name we haven't talked about yet, that group of guys coming back will give them enough of a bulwark against having to go out there and get a lot of pitching at the deadline, to which I say, we'll see. We'll see where they're at in the later part of July. Their farm system, they had to give up now a lot of prospects to make and furnish these moves in the last couple of years. They do a good job of developing talent, Julia, but they're now in a position where it's almost like you keep having to spend and spend and spend and spend and bring in more players from the outside because you're not able to keep your guys healthy. And that, unfortunately, has become the way that they're doing things. The one positive note I'll say is that Ben Kasperius is now in the rotation. He belongs in the rotation. He's been one of their best five starters for a long time with one of their best five pitchers, I should say. He's a reliever with like a four-pitch mix. He should start. And they have arrived at that conclusion because, frankly, right now, they don't have any other better options.
Yeah, Emmett Sheehan, by the way, is expected to expand to four innings in a rehab outing this weekend. So I think it's his fourth rehab term, but the first time he's going to stretch out to four innings. So they're going to be looking at that real close, real soon, I think. John, no, we got to let you go because you've got the MLB Network Showcase game tonight, Yankees at Royals. We will have to save the Kenny Serwa conversation for your next appearance.
Knuckleballs in the Tigers system. I'm excited about him. And hey, we could see, we have never seen a Tigers-Blue Jays full-on postseason series. That could change this year. I'll report live from Windsor or London as that's going on. I'm sure I'm representing both perspectives.
And we can carpool back and forth, John. Thanks so much for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. All the best.
John Morosi of MLB Network. And yeah, that name I brought up there, Kenny Serwa, is in the Tiger system. Fascinating guy. So he's 27 years old. He was a college player. He was bounced around a little bit in the low levels of the minors and then mostly played indie ball and then didn't play at all and then popped back up in indie ball last year, throwing an 88-mile-an-hour knuckleball.
Sure.
88 miles an hour. So the Tigers signed him out of indie ball.
Yeah.
He pitched at high A. He just got bumped up to double A now. So not that far from the majors is a guy who has figured out an 88-mile-an-hour knuckleball.
How old did you say he was?
27.
Oh, boy. That's great. That is exciting stuff.
Yes.
Oh, well, I know what I'm doing with my afternoon then.
Looking up Kenny Serwa highlights?
That is exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah.
My life is not that
interesting. Where's their double A? Their double A team's in Erie, so not even that far away. There you go. The Erie Seawolves. You can go check them out. Make sure you check out, too, John. John posted on social media a good interview he had with Seth Hernandez. This is part of MLB's draft coverage that's coming up, but he tweeted out a clip of it already. Seth Hernandez was named this week the Gatorade National Player of the Year among high school players. He's expected to be the number two pick in the upcoming Major League Baseball draft, which we'll talk about in mid-July because we'll have shows during All-Star Week, and that's the number one item on the docket. Get ready to learn some college guys,
buddy.
Yeah, that's right, the old Adam Silver meme. Good job. Okay, we're gonna take a break here on the next segment, the final segment of the day. There's no Blue Jays game today, so we got nothing to set up, we got no opponent to talk about or anything like that, so we're gonna take your text. There's already a bunch in the text line, but keep them coming. 590-590. You can text us questions you have, how you're feeling about the 12-2 run, anything that's on your mind, Jacob Mizorowski, whatever. We don't care. We'll take them all. 590-590, standard data and message rates may apply. As we come back from the break, it's all you. It's mailbag time. It's text line time. That's next as JS Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. And watch how I'm going to pull those last two segments together. During the break, Ken Rosenthal of The Athletic reporting that Aaron Civale,
yes,
who is of the Brewers, who moved to the bullpen, and Jacob Mizorowski is coming up to take his spot in the rotation, has, to John Morosi's point about this time of year, requested a trade.
What? You know what? This may be a wrong impression, but the requesting of trades is not something that happens in MLB.
I'm in the pocket back in my, I am wearing a basketball hoodie today. I was talking about basketball a little earlier. I also do a basketball show. This is very NBA.
Wow. Okay. Well, good for him, I guess.
But yes, Savale's agent told Ken Rosenthal and Will Salmon of The Athletic that they had a very professional conversation.
I'm sure.
And yes, Savale has asked out. If you are a Blue Jays fan who is looking at that, Savale has a 4.91 ERA right now. He only started five games. He had a kind of a late start there. And he makes $8 million this year. So it'll be, at this point in the season, about $5.5 million extra on the books the rest of the way. Strikeout rate looks okay. It's a small-ish sample. He, of course, had a 4.36 ERA last year over a full season of starting and was even better the season before that. So a little interesting.
Yeah.
That if he, you know, it's always one of those things of like, well, he's not good enough to be in the Brewers rotation. but the Blue Jays need SP5 help. They need long man in the bullpen help. I know we have some questions in the text line about say Spencer Turnbull and what his role is or whatever. Not saying a guy with a 4.91 ERA who's only pitched 22 innings this year is a solution for the Blue Jays or anything like that, but I do think when you are a smaller budget team like the Brewers and a guy you're paying $8 million, A, gets moved to the bullpen, and B, wants out, the asking price might not be crazy high.
Yeah, he was Savali was an interesting name, or a name to keep in mind at least before this, and this just adds a little bit of fuel to the fire when it comes to trade talks.
Yes, fuel to the fire, Nino Niederreiter. Yeah, it also ties our two segments with Derek Van Riper and John Morosi together nicely. This segment, though, is all you guys. It's we're opening up the text line, the mailbag. Julia, what do you got for us?
Okay, I'll start with a cute one from Glenn in Vaughan, who says, it was nice to hear about the gift from Matt, but Glenn thought it might be a sandwich, and I'm sure that that has something to do with...
Well, Matt was the sandwich hunter as a player. He had like a blog as he was around NBA cities, and yes, he will bring up his hunt for better sandwiches and the best sandwich around the city often on the show. We did an off-season episode with Garrett Temple of the Toronto Raptors where Garrett owed us sandwiches from a bet from earlier in the season. But no, just a nice Orlando Robinson card for me. He got Amit a Florida Gators shirt. The Gators, where Matt played, won the NCAA National Championship this year. And then...
Love that.
And then just some beers, no sandwiches.
Okay. Well, yeah. Beers will do, I guess. Did he pay for those? Or
no.
Did you guys split it?
Okay. Do your own bills. Come on.
All right. Let's actually move on to baseball questions here. Although it is nice to sprinkle in some basketball.
Yeah, I don't... Or anything. I don't care. Ask me about whatever.
Okay, Sean and Mark starts with a compliment. So brace yourself, Blake. I know you don't do well with those.
Pass.
Love Next what question. You two have been doing lately. Great show. Question on Spencer Turnbull and his role in the future. Is he a long man? Is he a fifth starter? I think my answer is we don't know yet. Where do you stand?
Yeah, it's going to be dictated by his performance. Yeah. Like, I don't think that he's locked into even like a roster spot. Mm-hmm. Like they gave him a major league contract and he'll make $1 million or whatever. But like if he comes out and looks in his next two appearances like he looked on his rehab stuff and the mechanics are out of whack and the stuff's not there, like he could very easily be Jose Urena'd mm-hmm. at some point and then someone else picks him up or Casey Lawrence if you prefer, whichever your DFA roller coaster guy is. I also think there's a possibility that he sticks as a long man, give you two innings here and there. I would think if we assume that Bowden Francis, and this is not a safe assumption, but for the purposes of this exercise, if Bowden Francis is going to maintain a rotation spot, then you're basically Lauer and Turnbull are probably in a competition. And if Max Scherzer comes back at one point, that competition is for the long man spot. If Max Scherzer is delayed or something like, or ineffective, mm-hmm. then that competition is for the fifth rotation spot. Now, if Bowden Francis gets bumped from the rotation at any point, that changes that conversation. All of this is to say, I think Spencer Turnbull is very much in control of what that role is going to look like. If he looks like he did for the Phillies last year, either one. If he looks like he looked on his rehab, probably not long for the roster. So
yeah.
I know that's like, it's not a cop-out answer, but it is really like we haven't seen enough Spencer Turnbull yet to really know. They were hoping when they signed him that like he was going to be SP5. Mm-hmm. Eventually, the 35 days was not enough to build him up to that point.
Yeah, frankly, based on what the reports had been from that ramp-up period, we weren't even sure he was actually going to get added to the roster. And I mean, obviously, with Bowden Francis struggling, that sorted itself out, and here he is. But it was no guarantee that Turnbull would even be here. So good for him for getting off to a good start, and we'll kind of see when it comes to pitch count, when it comes to, you know, leverage situations, how much the Blue Jays trust him either to come in or to stay in a game, and that should give us a bit more clarity here. But yeah, I think that the velocity on the fastball and the spin and the breaking ball, that really, you know, that will make or break any pitcher's season. So remains to be seen. Just to stay on the pitching side, and especially that whole SP5, SP4 situation there. Austin Mackey from the control room
is mad with power. You're not supposed to be able to send us questions from the control room. Come on.
Yeah, I don't know how this got in here, but I'll ask you because my job is to read this doc. And the question is, will Scherzer pitch more than 50 innings this season? That is a fascinating question.
Yeah, I think the smart money would be on the under. Mm-hmm. I'm hopeful that that is incorrect. But if we assume he's already not going to be back for, you know, he's going to start on Friday for Buffalo, 6:35 start, get your MILB TV ready. That'll be fun. He would need at least one more rehab start after that, it sounded like. And then you know, he comes back, but at that point, his pitch count, like, so we're already talking late June. Mm-hmm. His pitch count is maybe not all the way to fully stretch out. So you're hoping for 4 or 5 innings at a time. He only threw 43 and a third last year. You'd be very careful with it. And I assume, you know, if there's a day off in the schedule, he's getting the extra rest day and stuff like that. I hope I'm wrong. There's still a lot of season left, but I would probably go slightly under.
I would bet the under as well. And that's not to, you know, take anything away from Max Scherzer or try to imply anything here. It's just, you know, the history of the pitcher himself kind of shows us that it would be the safe bet here.
And like, this is the difficult part of the ramp up. Like, yeah. As he's ramped back up from this thumb thing, this is the point in time at which, like,
it's the 50 pitch.
Yeah,
threshold.
The playing catch has not necessarily been the issue. Yeah. The 20 pitch side session hasn't necessarily been the issue. It's when he gets to this point. So I hope I'm wrong though, because those three innings were electric, and I would love a cool second half run for Max Scherzer as a Blue Jay.
Okay, this is another pitching one. I'm just going to get them all out of the way before we move to the position player side. But this is actually one that I've thought about a lot, and so I want to get your take on it. So Tyler in London is asking, what is the best argument for not getting Trey Savage to the majors after the All-Star break? He's an older prospect, seems to be, quote-unquote, wasting quality innings in the minors when those could be used in the majors. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, I wouldn't say they're wasting them. I would say it's very telling that after just 4 appearances at high A, they bumped him to double A. I think he has nothing to show at the lower levels of the minors. They wanted to be mindful of too much too soon and make sure that he's going long enough in games, that the inning count is going to be high enough to keep building on long term and stuff like that. But yeah, this was a guy who did 3 years at a major college program, was one of the best pitchers in all of college baseball last year, has shown he's dominant at A and high A. I think the double A jump, the jump from high A to double A is probably the biggest jump that a pitcher takes until they make the jump to the majors. So this will be telling. Yeah. But if 4 or 5 starts into this one, he looks as good as he did in the other ones, and he's striking out 40% of batters, and the walks aren't that high. I don't see a reason why, like, yeah, there's like the 40-man roster and years of control and things like that. If he looks very good at double A and you are in a playoff push, like, I think of, this is a terrible example to use because we just found out yesterday he's undergoing Tommy John. Jackson Jobe, late season for the Tigers last year, give a couple innings in September. If he looks good, maybe even on the playoff roster. I think that is, a lot has to go well still for you, Savage. Like, it's only June 12th and he hasn't pitched above high A. But I think the aggressive push to double A here is in line with, what was it, Tyler? Is in line with Tyler's question. They want to be aggressive. They want to see A, if he struggles at double A, and B, if he does, how he responds to struggling, because the guy hasn't struggled since he was in like high school. I think strap the rocket. If he's really good at double A, get him to Buffalo by August and then start thinking about September. You know, he's the long man in September or something like that. A lot has to go right for that, but that, I think that scenario is like a non-0% scenario.
Yeah. Do you think that the 2020 season and the way that it happened and the fact that there was no minor leagues and all of that, has it changed the way that we see these older prospects a little bit?
I think it has, for me at least, it has more to do with the shrinking of the minor leagues, that there aren't, you know, short season leagues. Guys have to get promoted a little bit more. Like Tucker Thomann, for example, was, they picked 2 spots before Christian Campbell the other year, or 2 spots before Roman Anthony the other year rather, and is in single A for the 3rd time.
Yeah.
And that's not ideal, but he was a high school bat and he struggled, so you don't want to push him too fast. If he had come out and there was, you know, short league, and then you could build them up to A, and then, you know, I don't know. I think the loss of minor leagues, there are fewer minor league roster spots, there are fewer minor league levels. I think that has changed the accounting of how fast guys are going to move, how you balance valuing a prep prospect versus, you know, an established college, especially on the arm side. Like, I just don't think it's the risk profile of drafting a high school arm really high at this point. Like, look at Brandon Barriera, who the Jays took, and he's back in FCL action now after missing a lot of time. But the injury risk, the projection risk, even Mick Abel is another one that he was the 2020 draft, but he was like, I think, the only high school righty drafted in the first round.
I think you're correct.
And there was so much up and down. There's just so much risk in that profile. Yeah. So when it comes to, I think teams are right to value college arms a little bit more for the certainty and the projection. There's also an element of this, in addition to the minor league shrinking in Major League Baseball, And the 2020 thing is a factor. I believe this is the last draft class that'll be affected by 2020. There's also an aspect of, as like, college baseball, as I understand it, has gotten a little more condensed in terms of conference play. So like the power conferences are even more powerful now. So Atreyu Savage is not only pitching in a power conference at a top school, he's facing elite competition throughout the college season. There aren't bottom feeders in a conference like that in college baseball anymore. So the level of competition at the highest levels of college baseball has also improved.
That's a great answer. Wow, I did not expect you to go that deep, and it was very good. I certainly learned something from this, so thank you. All right, let's move on to the position player side. That's a lot of Scherzer and Turnbull questions here. So Matt in Keswick, I hope I'm saying that right, with the Blue Jays not having a true leadoff hitter, why isn't there more conversation about putting Clement in the role? I would say that it's probably because he doesn't walk, but that's kind of a simple answer. And also, Bobichat has been fine.
Yeah.
What do we think?
Yeah, I mean, like, Ernie Clement is like a different version of Bobichat.
Yeah, he's also not a true leadoff hitter, right?
Yeah, I don't think that changes that much. And yes, the name is pronounced Matt. You pronounce it correctly. I know you're saying Keswick, yeah. Because Bobichat is in the leadoff spot, I've had to budge on this. I like a high on-base profile in the leadoff spot. All else equal, I would like a guy who works a long at-bat, takes some walks, things like that. That is not Ernie Clement. I mentioned earlier, he is the most aggressive hitter in among all qualified hitters. That can be fine. I've talked about before, Bobichat in the leadoff spot has a niceness to it because while that's not a typical leadoff profile, if you're a starting pitcher, you have to, from pitch number one, be ready for a guy to jump all over you and be super aggressive. So you kind of have to come with your best stuff right out of the gate. Ernie Clement would have an element of that too. But if your problem is Bobichat is not quote unquote a typical leadoff hitter, Ernie Clement is a similar version of that. So I don't see how that fixes it. Ernie Clement's been great though. On a day Bobichat has the day off or something like that. Sure.
Yeah. The two things I would say is that one, all things considered, Bo is still a better hitter than Clement, even though if you look at the numbers right now, that may not translate as well.
I mean, Bo's still like...
Yeah.
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 Clement's coming off of a heater, and Bobichat's just kind of been like okay and is still like 20, 25 points ahead of him in OPS. And I think would project, like if we're projecting forward, you're betting on Bichat to have a better offensive season for me.
And I guess the tone setter moniker that was given to Bichette when he, you know, earned this this leadoff role is also something to consider here, right? He has a reputation, and two, he has a bit more power potential than Clement would in that role.
At least against righties, yeah.
Yeah, and so, yeah, I like Bo where he is. The other thing that I would say about taking Bo out of the leadoff spot is that he leads this team in RBIs, and you can only imagine what he would do a little bit further down the lineup when he has a bit more traffic on the bases.
Yeah, and that would
be
helpful.
He loves to do that.
Yeah, and that would be helpful for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. as well. The tough part is like if you did Clement, Bichette, Guerrero as your 1-2-3, and you say, okay, we've embraced Bichette as that type of leadoff hitter, but we want him more RBI opportunities. Clement's hitting well, at least against lefties, to put him up there. There's like a good chance a starting pitcher comes out and has like a 4-pitch first inning.
100%.
And that puts you behind the eight ball a little bit. Like having aggressive hitters is good, and like having versatility in the approach in the lineup is good. I don't know if I want to start the game with the two most aggressive hitters in baseball back to back. Because you're probably either going to have like runners on first and third and the pitcher's like swimming in deep water right away, or the pitcher's going back to the dugout with nothing on his pitch count.
Yeah. One of them hits a single and then Vladdy hits into a double play.
Come on.
Which leads me to my next question.
I will say to the person's question, to Matt's question though, I think power is still the thing that the Blue Jays will be looking at most closely when it comes to trade deadline stuff. But if that does not materialize, someone who fits the leadoff spot, because there is no one, even if Santander and Varsho come back, even if you were to, you know, there's nobody, they've called all the guys up for the most part other than Ralvis. None of those guys fit a typical leadoff thing. So it would be something in my mind.
Which does also lead us to this question from Richard in Milton. When do we start worrying about the lack of home runs from Vladdy? Or is it business as usual?
We've done this each of the last 3 years, and two of those years he ended up with 30-plus mm-hmm. still. I think at this point, like 2021, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. with 48 home runs is just not who he is, and that's not coming back. The swing and the way he is as a hitter is just not conducive to putting the ball in the air, especially at that level. I don't think he's going to do that anymore, but I think we've seen, like, he is right now about what he was, not last year, but the first half of last year, mm-hmm. and then it really came around. So I would obviously like to see more of this from him. It's not great that he's on pace for like 22 home runs, but we had this conversation late May last year, and then he found a heater. I think this is just who he is. He's a very hard contact hitter who is going to be streaky with the power.
Yeah, it took him a little bit last year too. And I think that the good news in a different thing about last year is that he actually had a pretty bad slump in which he was not even reaching base last year. He was chasing, he was pressing. It was clear he was uncomfortable. We're not seeing that this year. He's still, when he comes up in big spots like he did was it yesterday or 2 days ago? You know, it can be an RBI single. That's okay. The Blue Jays will take an RBI single from Vladdy. They'll bank in that run and keep, you know, creating some pressure on the bases like he has been able to do. So, yeah, I don't know. I will say that I'm a little bit just like my ears are perked up, I guess, about Vladdy and power just because yeah. It has been a while since we've seen him hit a home run.
Yeah, and I understand where the question is coming from. Like, again, like I'm very well versed in having the conversation and digging up the numbers on Vlad's power stuff because we've had this conversation at some point each of the last 3 years. Yeah. I just, like, we can go deeper on it, you know, maybe one day next week if he's still homerless through the weekend or something like that. But my snap reaction is that he will have a heater in there somewhere because that's what he did two of the last 3 years when we were talking about this. And I think the other year he finished with 26 or something like that. So,
and maybe this year, well, it looks like this year when this heater comes, the Blue Jays will actually be in a place to take advantage of it and gain some ground in the standings and make it count a little bit more.
Okay, we only have like 4 minutes left. So yep. Give me the one I pulled data for. Yep. I don't know what the question is, but I've got the data ready.
Michelle in Mississauga asks, are there any other utility gold glove contenders that play all four infield positions regular? This is obviously in reference to Ernie Clement and his push for a utility gold glove.
Okay, so I will have watched each of these players enough to tell whether they are gold glove caliber. However, Ernie Clement has played the four infield positions 30 innings plus. So I quickly pulled at the break everyone who's played 30 innings plus at four or more positions. The list isn't crazy long, but there are some names on it. Javier Sanoia with the Marlins, although his is three infield positions and two outfield positions. Okay. So that counts for the utility as well. Willy Castro with Minnesota has played three infield positions and two outfield positions that much. Brooks Baldwin with the White Sox, two infield, two outfield. Chris Taylor, who's come up a bunch, although center field, left field, right field is a little, then I get like, is that utility or are you just an outfielder? But he also played a bunch of second base.
Right on.
So he's in there. Enrique Hernandez for the Dodgers has played first, second, third, and center field. Ernie Clement is in there. And then Jared Triolo from Pittsburgh, Miles Mastroboni from Seattle, and old friend Santiago Espinal has played second, third, left, and right. Zach McKinstry in Detroit is the other one. So those are your guys who have played four positions, 30 or more innings. In terms of are any of them gold glove caliber, I believe Triolo and Sanoia both grade out really well by defensive runs saved. But I think Ernie Clement would be the lead at this point. If we're looking, if four positions is the cutoff,
yeah,
I think he's probably looking pretty good at the, 40% of the way mark right now.
Without looking, I would guess that Ernie Clement is lapping them right now because he's been so good defensively with the, really wherever you throw him, he has been the difference maker.
Yes. So he is, again, this is very, this is a very crude way of doing it, but I had to do it in one commercial break. He and Javier Sanoia both have 9 defensive runs saved across the multiple positions that they've played at. So it's close.
It is close.
Although Sanoia's in the National League.
There you go. Encouraging to see that a lot of these names are in the National League. So kudos to them. Yeah. They can win their gold glove over there.
Brooks Baldwin's gone full Tampa Bay Rays brain where he plays every position poorly, but it's valuable that you can play all over the place. He's also young. He'll probably figure it out and get a little bit better. But yeah, it certainly would look like, I don't know. I'd have to look at how they voted for the utility Gold Glove in the past too. If like if a three position guy is enough, if it's infield and outfield and something like Dylan Carlson, I don't think should be center field, left field, right field. That's not quite in the spirit of utility. I don't think. I think to me, you have to have like those are too similar a position. I don't know. Or maybe I'm just drawing the line because I want to say Ernie Clement is the leader. If you go down to three, Javi Baez gets interesting.
Right on.
Third, short, and center field.
That is a very interesting one.
He doesn't grade out as well as Ernie from a defensive run save perspective. Jose Caballero with the Rays has been pretty solid around the diamond as well. Anyway, there are a lot of answers. Ernie's sitting pretty good in the American League side of things at this moment in time.
May come down to playing time, honestly, in the second half and things like that. Because Javi Baez definitely isn't going anywhere, so that might be a difference maker here.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes. All right. That was a fun show. Thank you to Derek Van Riper of The Athletic and Rates and Barrels for joining us. Thank you to John Morosi of MLB Network for joining us. Again, that's Yankees Royals tonight, the MLB Network showcase game. Aaron Judge against Bobby Witt Jr. Thank you to all of you for your texts in the text line. The ones we didn't get to, we'll save. We'll try to get to them tomorrow or another day. No Blue Jays game tonight. We'll be back tomorrow at 10 a.m. anyway to talk about the Jays and Phillies series. Thanks again to Derek and John. Thanks to Ahmed Mond, Austin Mackey, Brandon Brown, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Hope you all have a wonderful Thursday.